when you outline all of the things that could go wrong, it would not be a rational decision to start a money transmission business. So I didn't. I just jumped in and started doing stuff and figuring out how to like block and tackle and plow through walls. And we eventually were lucky enough to plow through them. But it took some, like, I don't know, willful ignorance is the right term, but it took jumping in and just doing it as opposed to looking at all the risks and weighing the decision.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where I chat with Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and business leaders about how they think and how they operate. On this episode, I talked with Matt Oppenheimer. He's the CEO at Remitly. Lots of great headlines. 9 years out of Techstars Seattle, nearly $1 billion valuation, over 1,000 employees, 2 million customers, and over 300 million in equity raised. Matt went behind the scenes on his amazing story with Remitly. The road less traveled from business school to Kenya to finding a customer problem. His irrational decision to start Remitly that worked out well. How he differentiates, how he's pivoted, and how he's leading during the COVID-19 crisis. I'm sitting here with the one, the only Matt Oppenheimer. Hey, Matt, thanks for being here.
Hey, Adam, how's it going?
It's going well. And we're doing this through Zoom in social distancing mode. I'm sorry that we weren't able to meet in person a couple weeks ago when we originally had this scheduled.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you once we get through all this.
Likewise. I've been a big fan of yours since the early days of Remitly when we were both working in the Techstars office. It's been incredible to watch the growth that you've had. So I'm really excited to catch up. I've been looking forward to this interview.
Likewise. Yeah, a lot of fun memories from being back in that office. So we'll have to laugh about those here in a little bit.
Well, you always seemed steady at the wheel back then, like you knew where you were heading. And in some ways, I'm not surprised with the success you've had, but in some ways, it's just remarkable how far it's come quickly. Can you give just the quick stats on where you are as a business in whatever way you like to describe it?
Yeah, sure. So Remitly's vision is to transform the lives of immigrants and their families by providing the most trusted financial services on the planet. Remittances are the main thing that we do, but we just launched our second product, which is a bank account specifically designed for immigrants, which we heard from our customers is a huge pain point and big opportunity to improve their lives. So if you look at those two products, the remittance business is the one that's been around 9+ years. We have served over 2 million customers. We've raised over 300 million in equity. We have over 1,000 people worldwide, and we're growing very rapidly even in this environment. And then Passbook is relatively early days, but we launched that earlier this year and are seeing amazing customer interest in it. So expect big things from that in the months and years to come.
Wow, it's just crazy that amount of capital that you've brought in and the trajectory. How old is the business? What year was it founded?
It was May of 2011 is when I left Barclays Bank in Kenya and started the company. So coming up on 9 years.
Well, just an overnight success in 9 years. I had Glenn Kelman on the show several weeks ago, and I think he was about 14 or 15 years in. So I think it takes that much time, doesn't it?
Yeah, he was a mentor actually in Techstars in that old office we were just talking about. I still remember like looking at him with like awe and admiration. I still do. But yeah, he was 5 or 6 years ahead and had built, you know, a large business. And obviously that's grown since then. But I've learned a lot of lessons from Glenn. And one of them, as you just said, is businesses are not built overnight. And even the most successful businesses out there, I think there's this perception that there's some aha idea and it's all of a sudden this hockey stick growth and it all happens in days or weeks or months, and it is definitely years and a lot of hard work and pivots and other things along the way. So we've been lucky, though, over the last 9 years and built a business that serves a lot of customers at this point.
I know a little bit about your history. One thing I admire about you is that you've made a lot of seemingly unconventional decisions along the way. And my proof of this is that I heard you had an epic handlebar mustache when you were at Harvard Business School. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't know if unconventional decision or just bad decision, but yeah, no, that was fun. In my first year of business school, I don't know why I did this. It's not like I lost a bet. I think I actually thought it looked good at the time, but I had a handlebar mustache in Boston, Massachusetts at Harvard Business School for a significant part of my first year, and it was a lot of fun and embarrassing.
Were you known for that? That had to be quite unique in that group of people.
Well, it's funny. We did this exercise our first year where you get really close with your section of 90 people. And I was just going back and reading that. And we did this exercise where it's like people say, what do you admire about this person? And, you know, most people are like, oh, I love how compassionate you are, you know, you always have great insights. And like solid 2/3 of the comments about me were amazing handlebar mustache. I'm from Idaho. So there was a comment or two on nobody like represents his state heritage better. Nobody. It was 2/3 about my handlebar mustache. So I think it was memorable, which is good.
Left a mark for sure.
Yeah.
So I love looking at your history because you went from Harvard Business School and on this path, and I know there were steps in between, but you ended up at Barclays Kenya, you know, not McKinsey, not Goldman Sachs, not even Amazon, right? What led you down that?
Yeah, I think that was the road less traveled. Certainly, I think that a lot of folks, like you said, take investment banking, consulting, or, you know, large tech jobs coming out of business school. And for me, I've always been interested in people. I've always been interested in management, also interested in entrepreneurship, but I didn't have an idea coming out of business school that I wanted to, you know, really dedicate at least 10 plus years of my life to. So Barclays was a unique opportunity because it was in the corporate and retail bank, which is all about large scale people management. And I liked that it was international, which was the second thing I was looking for. I've traveled to close to 100 countries because of Barclays. I've lived and worked on 3 different continents. I started with them in London. And then I really joined them because I've always been drawn to Africa, and I had done some trips there previously, some volunteer work. And so after my first year at Barclays in London and the corporate bank, I moved to Kenya and ran mobile and internet banking initiatives for Barclays Bank Kenya. And that's really why I joined Barclays, is because not only London, but Kenya, such a unique opportunity. And because it was a lot of, you know, just exposure to what it means to manage a large business in terms of not only size of revenue and profits, but also just, you know, corporate and retail bank have a lot of people. And I learned from a lot of really talented, good managers there.
What was the appeal to Africa specifically?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it's extremely different in some ways. There's a humanity about everyone I've met across so many cultures that are actually very similar, but in a lot of ways, it's very different. And I'm drawn to difference. I'm drawn to getting to know people that are very different than me. I think a lot of people are drawn to similarities, and I really enjoy learning from people that are very different from me and have a different perspective on life. And so I think that's part of it. And after living there, I learned so many lessons on life from a lot of my Kenyan friends. The nature is unbelievable and gorgeous, like, you know, safaris and all that, like nothing I've ever seen. And I went on safaris when I lived there in my like Toyota Corolla. These are not fancy safaris. And when I say difference, I think that it's also just the people there are just unbelievable, unbelievable. And I'm talking, Africa is a big place. I'm talking about Kenya specifically, which is where I traveled and where I went back and lived. But so grateful for the people I met and everything they've taught me.
Are there any values or principles that you've brought to Remitly that came from those people that you met in Kenya and the kind of unique traits that you found in the community there?
Yeah, one comes to mind, which is, you know, I think that there's a tendency, I think at times in fast-paced cultures, and this is somewhat in the US and also just the cultures and places that I run into, like jump into the topic at hand, into work, into business. And what I learned very, very quickly in Kenya is if you walked into a meeting and you were like, all right, here's the agenda, here's what we're going to be doing, let's go. I mean, obviously wouldn't say it like that, but I think there is that tendency in a lot of corporate America. You just wouldn't get taken seriously. You wouldn't get anything done. And so I really slowed down at the beginning of a lot. I still slow down at the beginning of a lot of meetings just to really genuinely check in. How's your family? How's life? And I do that not only because it results in a more productive meeting, or it resulted in Kenya in a more productive meeting, but more importantly, it's just like a way more interesting way to live life, to connect with people. And it was most stark when I went from Kenya back to London, and I was in the process of leaving Barclays, but I went and caught up with a few colleagues, and I jumped in and asked about that person's family as opposed to jumping right in. And what I realized at that moment, because I had just come back from Kenya, it was kind of like then habit, is that I had never asked this guy how his family was doing. And it was almost like awkward because it was like this change in the paradigm of our relationship. And so anyway, that's one very tactical thing, is like slowing down, getting to know people at a very genuine level, checking in at the beginning of meetings, and taking, you know, a more personal approach is something I certainly learned from my Kenyan colleagues.
So people still see that today at Remitly when they're in meetings with you checking in and sort of putting that person as a priority before kind of getting down to the agenda?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So this unconventional road, you went to Kenya, and I know that had a big influence on, you know, ultimately what you did with Remitly. How did that kind of earned secret come out of your time in Kenya and lead to the insight for Remitly?
Yeah. Well, first, the road less traveled was because I've had great mentors. And I remember when I was at Barclays in London, I talked to one of my mentors, this guy, Mark Solon, who was one of the leaders at Techstars globally. And he's just a great guy, but he's from Boise, Idaho. And so I've known him forever. I was debating between working my way up in the corporate bank versus going to Kenya. And most of my peers were like, why would you leave the mothership of One Churchill Place at Barclays? Like, how are you going to build a career here? How are you going to get promoted? How are you going to interact with all the big wigs at the mothership? And I'm so glad I had people like Mark to be like, take the road less traveled, like go. And I think what doing that did for me in terms of taking the road less traveled is it exposed me to different problems, different challenges, different innovations. And the specific pain point I saw in Kenya was that a lot of my Kenyan friends who had relatives in Europe or North America relied on them for money for their basic living expenses and had really strange ways of getting that money. Like one of my friends had like her sister's Bank of America debit card. And I was just like, what happens if you lose that? There's obviously compliance concerns, but like more so for that, for her, like the costs, the inconvenience, the uncertainty. And so I remember vividly examples like that. And in Kenya, there was a mobile wallet and is a mobile wallet called M-Pesa that really has transformed domestic financial services. So I was kind of like, now seems like the time to actually apply that kind of shift to mobile and shift to digital to remittances and improve people like Fiona and Fiona's sister's lives in terms of getting money back. Fiona was the friend that I mentioned that had her sister's debit card.
So when you saw those situations, like what you saw with Fiona, did you start systematically interviewing people or was it just something that you kind of got by osmosis being there and seeing the different ways that people moved money around to family and kind of internationally?
Yeah, no, it was mainly, I didn't really do a lot of like deep customer development, nor did I even realize at the time that Fiona obviously is not the customer, like Fiona's sister's the customer. And so I was pretty far from the customer at that point. I just knew that there was a pain point that it seemed like the right opportunity and time to solve.
Got it. What was it about that you saw that kind of lit that up for you versus, you know, any other problem that you could observe in the world? What was it about that pain point that really became interesting to you?
Two things. One, and most importantly, it was super meaningful. And I don't think 9 years in, if we were a business making widgets, I'd have a hard time continuing to stay motivated. It is so motivating. And it's especially motivating right now in the middle of COVID-19 because our service is always essential. But if there's a recession happening, remittances can mean the difference between having food on the table or not for our customers, recipients. It can mean the difference between having emergency medical care or not. And so that by far, seeing how far that money went and the meaning is the primary. And then the second is I wanted it to be a big problem and I wanted it to be a big problem that had scaled solutions, which usually takes technology. I think people jump too much to wanting to start a quote tech company, but I liked that it was a meaningful problem and I liked it was a big problem and I liked that there were technical solutions to be able to solve it because that was a way to have a real global impact.
I'm very interested in this question that entrepreneurs have of like, do I want to swing for the fences? Or do I want to build something small? Or where on that spectrum do I want to live? And you've seemed like since the early days, you were very clear, like I wanted to go after a big problem. You mentioned, you know, am I willing to spend 10 years on this? How big is the opportunity? What drove you to think in that way at such an early stage in the business?
When I started the business, I was in my late 20s. I was not married. I had no kids. And startups, especially at the beginning, I mean, throughout the whole journey, but especially at the beginning where like you are the only resource basically. And the amount of time and energy and commitment it takes is enormous. And so I knew that at that point, one, I could take more risk because I lived, like when I moved back from Kenya, I moved to Boise, Idaho, where I grew up and I lived in the basement of a buddy of mine that I went to preschool with. Like my personal expenses were so low. And I also knew that I could dedicate 100% of my time. When I then did Techstars, I remember I lived in Fremont and I moved real upgrade from my buddy's guest room that I went to preschool with to my cousin's couch and his cat, George. Loved that cat. And all I would do is I would like work out, have Thai food, three great Thai places in Fremont, by the way. And since this is a Built in Seattle podcast, if anybody ever wants to talk about Thai food in Fremont, I have a rating system for all the Thai places. I like never cooked a meal. I was just wholly dedicated to building this. And I don't celebrate the fact that like I put in a lot of hours, because that is not something to celebrate. But I do think it's important to recognize that early stage startups are taxing and grueling and take a huge amount of time. And I had that at that point in my life. So those were some of the factors at that point that I was just intentional. But I don't think that a venture-backed, like swing for the fences startup is for everybody at every point in their life. And I think that it's important to be intentional. All businesses take times, but certainly like venture-backed tech startups, like they're just time. And I was obviously not earning a paycheck, so being able to spend less at that point in my life was also valuable.
That's awesome. Yeah, the friends basement to the couch is not the biggest upgrade I've ever heard of.
My cousin was very nice to let me stay on his couch. It was very nice.
I'm curious, in those early days when you were teaching people about this opportunity and this vision that you had, what was kind of like the why now story that you had, right? And how did you take that insight that you got from being in Kenya and being in banking and articulate that to investors and employees and early on getting people to see what you saw?
I think that certainly the M-Pesa perspective and living in Kenya, I think, provided a level of credibility and unique, like, why now? Because I had seen that there, which was, I think, got investors' attention because they were like, this is a different kind of perspective on things. So I think that was a big part of it and really is why we've been able to grow over the last 9 years, because there is a shift to digital. People are trusting digital devices for financial services, which has not been the case for a lot of years. And I think that was a big part of it. But here's the deal. I had no idea about anything remittance related when I started the business. I think that had I known all the complexity that is required to build a money transmitter, I don't know if I would, like, it's not a rational decision to start a money transmission business. It is so incredibly complex. And when you outline all of the things that could go wrong or all the things you have to solve, it would not be a rational decision to start a money transmission business. So I didn't, I just jumped in and started doing stuff and figuring out how to like block and tackle and plow through walls. And we eventually were lucky enough to plow through them, but it took some, like, I don't know, willful ignorance is the right term, but it took jumping in and just doing it as opposed to looking at all the risks and weighing the decision.
That's interesting. So you had enough domain knowledge to kind of find the problem and feel confident to go address it, but not enough to be dissuaded from attacking this like massively complex market.
Exactly.
How did you come to terms with like Western Union, this company that's been around since the 1850s, I think, and they're doing, you know, $5 or $6 billion in revenue. And as I understand, that's kind of who you were disrupting. Did people say, nobody's beat these guys in the last 150 years, why are you going to do it? And what was your thinking on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing about money transmission is that it's super fragmented. Like Western Union has, it's such a huge market that, you know, 600 plus billion is sent every year. Western Union has 17% market share. MoneyGram has 5%. And so I never really felt like, I mean, at an aggregate level, they are the ones to beat in the sense that customers are going to be much better off with the digital solution. But I never viewed them as like the 800-pound gorilla that we had to crush. I viewed more as like, it's a huge market and how can we get customers to help us. Certainly along the road, there have been folks from what I'll just say are legacy players. I'm not going to name out, like, if it was Western Union, MoneyGram, whoever, if it was executives or former executives from those places. But the idea of like pitching and transforming remittances with a digital solution is not a new one. And so I think they oftentimes were like jaded and it was like, oh, cute. And like, you don't have any idea about all these barriers and you're going to be shut down in 3 months because you won't be able to get through them all. And then you're going to come back looking for a job. And that did fuel me because I just thought it was arrogant and annoying. And so that was the biggest association I have, was the like arrogance and complacency, both because I found it personally offensive and because I felt like customers were the ones that were losing by that arrogance and complacency, which created an opportunity.
That's such a great sort of guide to find opportunity as well, right? Like if you can find that sweet spot where the customer isn't benefiting and the industry is kind of ignoring it, how did you know when you had locked into that kind of right area? Like, what were the clues or signals that you were getting back then that told you, despite what people were saying, that this was the right thing to go attack?
It was interesting. When we first started, we made a few early pivots. And there was a Techstars mentor that actually said it in a crass way that still stuck with me. And I wish I could remember the Techstars mentor's name because he would get credit for it. But he said, find something that pisses you off. And it could be find a huge opportunity that nobody solved. But I think that I did find something that pissed me off. It pissed me off how expensive it is, how inconvenient it is, and how scary it is for immigrants to send money back to their home country. And these are folks who have traditionally been underserved, who make huge sacrifices to leave their families. And then after they make that sacrifice, and they make that sacrifice to support their families back home, and you're talking about like your parents, your kids, your siblings, like close family members you've left and haven't seen in years oftentimes, for the center of that being the remittance to be inconvenient, expensive, et cetera, pissed me off. And so the early days, I didn't zone in on here's the solution as much. And that's where that wisdom is. It's find something that pisses you off. It's not like find a product and solution you love. It sounds obvious, but I think a lot of entrepreneurs get that wrong. And so that did stick with me because that shifted my view in Techstars. And so the original solution was, let's create like the kayak for remittances and build a search engine just to provide more transparency on pricing. And then I don't have to go and build like all of the regulatory fraud prevention, security, all the different barriers. But pre-product, or just as I was starting to build product, I talked to a bunch of businesses who had just failed in that space. There was no business model. So then we pivoted to being the money transmitter, again, without knowing full context of how difficult it would be. But it was like, well, that's the next place to go solve this problem that pisses me off. And it took a little while to get real product market fit, because when we pivoted, we said, well, let's send money to mobile wallets, because mobile wallets were huge in Kenya. And so it was mobile to mobile, and it sounded good. But when we expanded, well, not even we expanded, when we sent money to the Philippines, which was our first market, out of 100,000 transactions, once we actually did get scale, we partnered with a mobile wallet to start. We started asking people to buy the product. We'd go, like, we only had a Washington State money transmission license, so we'd go to like South Center Mall, and we like rented the kiosk in front of one of the like old school money transmitters in the mall right out in front of Seafood City. And we'd ask customers to, you know, use it and send money to this, you know, mobile wallet, and nobody did. And so now, as I was saying, out of 100,000 transactions, like 20 transactions out of 100,000 go to this mobile wallet. So we had to broaden our range of disbursement options to cash pickup, to instant bank deposits, to all the different types of disbursement options. That really varies by country. But going back to your question of like when we knew we were onto something, we had to pivot again to be broader than just mobile wallets and have a broad range of disbursement networks. And from when we started the business to when we pivoted and started getting some traction, it was probably a year and a half. And then I think that once we started marketing a product that really resonated with customers, we started to, you know, get some scale, and it felt like something was there.
Can you tell me about those conversations that happened at South Center Mall? Because I just love that story. And yeah. Did you get validation about people's pain? And were they saying, this pisses me off too? Despite the fact that they were telling you clearly they didn't want it to go to the mobile wallet?
Our goal was not to get a bunch of customers at that point. Our goal was to learn from customers. And they weren't buying our product, but we didn't know why. And then it really took Alex's partnership and getting folks to feel comfortable and have them feel like they weren't insulting me by saying my product sucked, but really understand why they weren't using it. And that's what led us to broaden the range of disbursement networks. Although broadening the range of disbursement networks led to a whole nother challenge that I can talk about if it's helpful, but it was a critical next pivot and step to build what we've built today.
You've struck me as very mission-driven in the business, but what is that specifically that is helping have an impact on people's lives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's become even more meaningful over the last 9 years, because I think it's a tough time to be an immigrant, which are most of our customers are first generation immigrants in the United States, in Europe, in other places. And when I started the business, I would have said that, you know, the value that and the mission of what we're doing is about saving our customers money, about getting their money home faster. And that is certainly still part of it. A few dollars of savings goes an incredibly long way to our customer base. And that's a key part of the mission. But what I've learned since building the business is because it's so complex, even the legacy money transmitters, I don't think have ill intent, but they treat a lot of their good customers like criminals as they're trying to get their right compliance and fraud system set up, but may not be as sophisticated. And more importantly, culturally, they don't treat their customers like the heroes that they are, and they don't give them the amount of respect that they deserve. And I think that to give immigrants right now the peace of mind that their money is going to make it home with a company that's going to support them while they're in a new country, in a new place, in a period in time where they may be even more fearful or disrespected, I think is what it's all about. And as part of that, it is about saving them money. It's about speeding up the process, but it's rooted in the peace of mind and support that we can give them because they're working so incredibly hard to support their families back home. And that's the heart of why they've made the sacrifice to be in a new, different, and oftentimes scary place. So supporting them is ultimately what it's all about.
Yeah, I had Sarah Itoukas on the podcast a couple weeks ago as well. It was a different, completely different kind of business, but also serving immigrants. And she said that she's been getting all kinds of, you know, questions and email from the community as this crisis with COVID-19 has ramped up. And there's just been kind of this huge influx of need for help. How is that showing up in your business, and how are you changing to respond to that now?
So the first way it's showing up is that it's remarkable that 70%+ of remittances are sent from physical cash locations, like a Western Union or MoneyGram location that you think of. And the reason that is because that number is growing really rapidly as it shifts digital, and it was steadily growing. But payments are sticky. They're a thing of habit. And if you're, again, in our customer shoes and you know the local, you know, person who runs that agency, and you're sending $300 of your hard-earned money and you make $20,000 or $30,000 a year, and for compliance reasons, any money transmitter has to collect personal information about you, and then you're giving them your money and trusting it'll be delivered, oftentimes in cash, thousands of miles away at home. Like, this is where I say it doesn't just come down to price, because it's not logical to save $2 if you have any fear of your personal information being stolen or that money being taken from you. So it's a sticky thing. And what's happening right now is that it's two things. One, customers either don't feel safe or can't go to a physical location because they're closed. And two, money is more important than ever, as I mentioned, to get back home to our customers, loved ones. And so you see digital players like us growing really rapidly in terms of new customers. If you look at our February to March numbers, our new customer growth from February to March grew by 100% month on month, which for our scale and size is a very, very big jump. And that's continued into April. And if you look at our existing base, also from February to March, our volumes increased by 40%. I'm concerned about our customers' ability to continue to be employed. And so I think the medium term, there's a bit more of a question around that. But it's something we're monitoring closely. And it's something that if you look at previous recessions, remittance has been remarkably resilient because it is so important for our customers to get money home when there's a global crisis, because it, as I mentioned, goes so far back home. And but this recession, I think, will have higher unemployment. We're already seeing that. And so I think our customers will be affected. We'll be there to support them. And I think they'll continue to make it a priority compared to a lot of other businesses and industries. Other things we're doing to support them is, yeah, we're just trying to figure out how to, you know, keep our team safe, stop the spread of COVID, and keep especially our customer service levels to levels that are adequate. And there was a period there where we were short-staffed on the customer service side, so our wait times were longer, but we've now largely gotten folks to be able to work from home and or stay safe. And so we're getting those wait times back. They're back now to a place that's better. But it's been, you know, I've been inspired by the Remitly team on how much they've rallied to serve our customers right now, because it's been a trying time for the Remitly team. It's been an exceptionally trying time for our customers. I think it will continue to be for a while, and we just got to manage through it. But again, when there's meaning in the work, it makes it way, it fuels you, I think, to a level that is, at least what I've seen from the team, so inspiring.
How are you messaging to the team to bring that meaning front and center in their work, especially at a time, right, when everybody has their own personal challenges, whether it's a kid running around or maybe they have a family member who's been sick. I'm curious, you as the leader and your leadership team, what does it actually look like to, you know, keep the team focused on the right things for your customers during this crazy time of uncertainty in all our lives?
Mm-hmm. I think first the team has to know that we care about their well-being, both physically and mentally. And so I was talking earlier about some of the lessons I learned from my Kenyan colleagues, but those are especially applicable now. And I think the team knows how much we care and are looking out for their well-being and doing what's right by them. And I think that's such a case-by-case thing in terms of whether people have kids that they need to take care of and any sort of adjustments that need to be made to their lives to make that happen and be able to work. I think there's different challenges if somebody's alone and the loneliness that comes with that. I think there are different challenges if folks had, you know, mental health challenges and how this might make those worse. And so there's no one size fit all, but I think that's where culture matters, where our managers across the entire company really matter to be leaning in and on a case-by-case basis, connecting with their team and understanding where they're at. And then, you know, the mission part is what, in the midst of this, I think has brought in a lot of meaning to people. I had one person who's been in the Seattle office because our Nicaragua, Philippine, Mumbai, and Colombia customer support sites were at limited capacity for a while. As I mentioned, our Seattle team's been pitching in directly with a lot of customer service. And I had one team member say, you know, serving customers right now has been what's gotten me through this because it's provided so much meaning and so much in a tangible way that I can actually help people. So I think that people are looking for meaning right now and looking for ways to help as long as they're taken care of. And there's a balance there. You can't ask too much from people right now, especially people in some of those scenarios that I mentioned. But to the extent people have capacity, I think they want to help right now. And I think that our job gives them the ability to do that.
I'm curious if there's things that you're doing now in the business, either as a result of COVID or just in general, that won't scale but are important. Because I imagine just being, you know, at the size that you are and with the amount of capital you raise, the board meeting conversations are a lot about scalability and thinking in the long term. Are there any things that you've had to come back to now that kind of are akin to going to the South Center Mall or things that really probably won't scale but are important to focus on at this time?
For sure, yeah. And specifically, it is the like all hands on deck, everybody, including myself, doing customer support directly. And that does remind me of the early days where, you know, we didn't have a customer support staff, a dedicated customer support staff for a long while. And when we didn't, we all were on call, like not quite 24/7, but pretty close. And when you put engineers and product managers and others like directly managing customer issues, like they have a deeper empathy and they just go and fix things because they have the skills to do that, especially when most customer contacts are some sort of product defect. So I've seen us drive a lot more customer empathy right now with people jumping back to kind of that early day mentality of like handling direct customer support. It's not scalable because like we've got, you know, senior leaders to engineers to product managers where it's not their day job to do that, but it will make them better at their day job coming out of this.
So you've actually had to put your hands on some support tickets in recent weeks?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's painful with customer issues, but I have a lot of meaning that comes from that. And customers have reached out to me on all sorts of channels that I respond to. So yeah, definitely been helping customers directly, which is super meaningful.
That's awesome. I'd like to kind of wrap up with the Supersonic Six, which is the rapid fire round, a nod to our former NBA team that I miss deeply. So number one is, who are some role models or a role model company or person in Seattle that you're following now, especially as you're in this kind of elite class of companies that have gotten into the $1 billion ballpark? Who do you look at the next level that you're learning from or studying?
Mm-hmm. First one comes to mind is Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft. I think he is an empathetic leader. I think he has shifted an organization that has been around for a long time to instill continuous learning, a growth mindset, which he talks about a lot. I think he cares deeply about his team. And the results have been amazing in terms of what he's produced. But I think what I'm more inspired by is how he's produced those results. And anytime I've met the guy and gotten to know him a little bit, which I've had the privilege of doing, he's just real. What you see is what you get. He's a great human. So, Satya.
Wow, what a gift that you've gotten to spend time with him and learn from him. Number two, who's an up-and-coming company or person in Seattle or the Pacific Northwest that you're supporting right now or following?
Good question. The person that comes to mind right now is Mona Akmal, who's the founder and CEO of Falcon AI. And she's super early stage. She did a round recently with Greylock, which is obviously a really great investor, with Trilogy, who's one of our investors and also a great investor. I think that she is just a very smart, real, diverse, awesome person that every time I talk to her, I learn as much as anything I share. So she's in super early stages, but definitely somebody to keep an eye on, because I think she's going to be up to some great things.
Awesome. I'll put a link to her profile in the show notes and everybody can check her out. Number three, what's one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
You know, it's changed. I think it used to have not as much of a community like 9 years ago. It was really Techstars. I think it's got a great community of entrepreneurs now. I think it's got amazing, amazing talent, both at the big hubs as well as now the spinoffs. I think it's probably capital. I think that it still pales, the amount of capital here still pales in comparison to the Bay Area, New York, some of the other startup hubs. So I would say it sounds very tactical, but I think capital is the lifeblood of companies. And I think that it's harder to raise capital from an investor who's not in the same city as you. There are a lot of studies that show that. So I'm going to go with capital.
Number four, if you could go back to the beginning, would you still found your company in Seattle?
Definitely. It was a contrarian decision in 2011 because Amazon was tiny comparatively back then. I got questioned all the time, like, why are you in Seattle, not the Bay Area, somewhere else? And Seattle has been amazing. It's the things I just mentioned, the community, the talent, the lifestyle is amazing. I love Seattle, so I'd do that again in a heartbeat. And I picked Seattle. I was in Boise. Obviously, I wasn't going to build this business in Boise. As much as I would have loved to as a first-time entrepreneur, that would have been too hard. But I wanted to be on the West Coast. I just got back from Kenya. I was debating between Seattle and San Francisco. And like, thank God I picked Seattle. And it's also just way more on my alley in terms of culture. Bay Area is a little too over the top for me. I would have gotten tired of going to like dinner parties and talking about who's investors and what valuation. Like, there's a little of that here, but it's way toned down from the Bay Area. And that's just more my speed and style. So absolutely.
Well, I'm certainly glad you decided to do it here. Number five, what's a book that's had an impact on you recently that you would recommend to others?
The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. Others might have mentioned that. It's a little bit cliche, but it is just a priceless book. And the reason I love that book is because it's a collection. It reads as a book, but it also is just fundamentally a collection of his blogs. And so for early stage and kind of middle stage entrepreneurs, you can just pull up the chapter that's applicable. And it's like such tangible, helpful, great advice.
Love it. I mean, the wartime, peacetime CEO model certainly applies right now as we're looking at a pandemic.
Yeah.
Number six, what asks do you have for this audience, or what can this community do to help you?
Oh, to help me. I don't have any asks for me, although there's plenty that I need help with. I think what's more important is right now there are a lot of people that are suffering because of COVID-19, and it's hard to know how to help at times. And some of us aren't in a position to help because we're struggling with our own challenges. But for those that are able to help our community right now, I think that whether it's giving, there's amazing outpouring for like organizations like All in Seattle. And there's a list of organizations that is a good vetted short list of organizations that folks can help. That's one. There's advocacy and things that, you know, folks can do on that front. There's remote, you know, volunteering, but there's also just reaching out to a friend that might be lonely. There's thanking somebody who's on the front lines, checking in with them. I'm actually thinking about somebody I should check in with right now that's a doctor in the Bay Area that's on the front lines, who's a buddy of mine from college. Like, I think those things, like, that's what we need right now in the world, is that connectivity and intentionality when we're all holed up and quarantined. So that would be my ask of folks if there's one thing to do. Oh, and the one other thing I'd say is, given the customers we serve, is if there's an overlay on that of recognizing how lonely it can be from what we've heard from our customers to be an immigrant. And so I think about like the intersection of what I just said and like what it must be like to be like a Filipino nurse right now that is thousands of miles away from, you know, their kids, their parents, their families, and in a very scary situation serving COVID-19 patients. And so I think just holding up immigrants in esteem and respect for the sacrifices they're making to help our communities right now would be another very important thing that I think we can all do to make the world a better place, to improve their lives, and to help, you know, immigrants continue to contribute to our communities, which they do in a remarkable way.
Thank you for that. That's such a great reminder that even some little things can be helpful. And definitely for me personally, I have a few people I should go check in with after we hang up. I love hearing the story and catching up with you, Matt, on Remitly. It's been remarkable to just watch from the early days of sharing that office to see how far you have come. For people that want to follow you or keep in touch, where should they go?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, just Matt_Oppy, O-P-P-Y. You can follow me on LinkedIn. I post various articles on there. Or you can always just email me. It's just matt@remitly.com.
And are you hiring at the moment?
We are. We're one of the few companies right now that is hiring. So you can go to the careers page on our website and see. I think we've got about 25 open roles right now in Seattle. So yeah, if you're interested in a mission-based, exciting journey and there are any roles on there that excite you, please apply.
I highly recommend it. Thank you so much for being here today, Matt.
Thanks, Adam.
Is it on? I think it's on. Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again.